Media Focus with Paul Blanchard.
This week, The Economist. After 172 years, Zanny Minton-Beddoes has been appointed the first female editor. Why did it take so long? Global expansion plans at Netflix. The online service says it will reach 200 countries by 2016, financed by at least $1 billion in debt. Is the company now outreaching itself? And reports of the death of Page 3 seem to have been exaggerated. What was The Sun playing at? And as usual, we're joined by two of the media's best and brightest. Christina Nicolotti-Squires is editor at Channel 5 News, and Robert Cookson is digital media correspondent at the Financial Times.
Media Focus.
So, first up, Zanny Minton-Beddoes has been appointed to succeed John Micklethwaite as editor of The Economist and will become the first woman to edit the magazine in its 172-year history. Her appointment comes after the House of Lords conducted an inquiry into the underrepresentation of women in broadcasting. The report concluded that media organisations need to do more to encourage women into news and current affairs. Christina, why do you think there are so few female editors in the media, and were the press right to make this story about her gender?
Are there too few of us senior women in top posts in broadcasting the media? I don't think it's a question of too few. I think people should get the job irrespective of whether they're male or female, and there will come a time, I'm sure, when the numbers become a bit more numerous. There will be more of us. There's been a huge generational change in the last 50 years, and that's a process that's continuing. I get a bit bored sometimes about being asked about, is it hard being a woman in a senior position? I don't think it's any harder being a woman than it is being a man. Actually, I thought it was quite interesting on Zanny's appointment. The fact that she was a woman was reported, and I think that was probably right, actually. That was the newsworthy line. I think it was the first, she was the first ever female editor-in-chief of The Economist, that bastion, if you like, of the establishment in its 171-year-old history. And I think that the fact that she was a woman was part of the news. I thought it was really interesting, actually, in that maybe things have changed, because there was no discussion about her husband. There was no discussion about how many kids she had or didn't have. Most of the articles I looked at just kind of stuck to the straight story.
So it was less sexist than before?
Yes, I think so. And I don't know whether it's because people don't think The Economist is a sexy publication or whether we've actually really moved on. But there did seem to be not as much focus on her domestic life as perhaps might have been reported in other things. Even the Daily Mail didn't refer to her husband or her domestic life. So maybe we really have moved forward. The House of Lords report was interesting. I do think there is a shortage, perhaps, of women at the top. I do think that will change. It's kind of really up to us women to change that. It's not really a job that men are going to do for us. I've got a number of colleagues who were posting comments on social media about it. And they were both women who were really, really bright, really, really talented, and who had decided to take a step back, if you like, to bring up their families. I don't denigrate them for that at all. But I did say to them, well, it's up to you. It's up to us to put ourselves in those positions, make those decisions. Yeah, I do a full-time job. I've got two kids who are 8 and 12 and a husband. Couldn't do it without him. Do it in spite of the kids. But I don't make it... It's not harder, I don't think, for me to make it work than it would be for a man. I had a question the other day in an interview. A student of journalism was asking me about my work-life balance. And she said, oh, how do you make your work-life balance work for you? We're all really worried about it. And I said, well, do the boys on your course sit in the pub and go, oh, how are we going to make our work-life balance work for us? And I think it's something that we as women need to decide that we want to progress in our careers and we're going to go as far as we can and we'll make all the rest work. And I don't think it's that impossible to do. It's not easy, but I don't think it's that impossible to do.
Robert?
I thought it was absolutely the right top news line. You know, first woman in 172 years clearly is the exceptional thing. But what was quite interesting, I thought a lot of the reports I read delved into a lot of the detail besides her gender, which is quite interesting. So traditionally, the editors of The Economist have been in their late 30s, typically under 40. She's a bit older than that, at 47. She's also a long-time Economist insider, been there about two decades. So in some respects, they're going for a very archetypal, traditional
safe
Economist. Exactly, exactly.
One who happens to be a woman.
Exactly that. Interestingly enough, of the three shortlisted candidates for the job, one was Tom Standage, their digital editor, who you might have thought would be a good pick given the huge upheaval in the media, you know, which The Economist is obviously experiencing itself at the moment, that they passed him over and went for one of their, I suppose, core kind of business and economics-based stalwarts was quite interesting and perhaps tells us a little bit about their priorities.
And do you think, Christina, that they are the Economist is the kind of last bastion of the establishment in journalism, as it were? I mean, they don't even put bylines on the articles, so in one sense it doesn't even matter. But in another sense, from a societal point of view, it clearly is very important.
From some of the research I did, they've actually got quite a lot of, I think they've got something like a quarter of their staff are women, which is more than their readership, because their readership apparently is only 13% women. Maybe women are put off because there has a masculine sort of feel to it. Maybe that's tradition. Maybe the city and business and politics and economics are still regarded as much of a man's world. I think the fact that they don't have bylines perhaps means that people shouldn't really sort of be able to genderise, if you like, or tell what gender has written an article. Very interesting. If you've got a load of newspaper articles and you cut out the bylines and you guess which one was written by a woman and which one was written by a man, I think it'd be a really interesting experiment to do. I suspect you might be able to tell, but maybe we should do it for another podcast one day.
We should do that, shouldn't we? But when Coke and Pepsi do the blind taste test, people can't tell the difference, can they? So you have to be quite discriminating.
As you were saying earlier, I think that she's been given this job because she is a traditionist. She has got a solid background in economics. They have a history of recruiting from amongst their own, and she is from amongst their own, who happens to be a woman. And I think that the sort of the female side of, although is interesting and is probably the top news line, didn't really have much to play. There's an interesting period coming up because at the moment there were these two vacancies. There's one at The Economist and there's also a vacancy at The Guardian. And there are some women being lined up for that. Until now, we haven't had a female editor of The Guardian or The Times or The Observer. So it'll be very interesting to see how that progresses. And we might find that over the next sort of 4 or 5 years, women being in charge at the top is not really much of a news story.
Robert, The Economist subscriptions are tailing off a little bit. Do you think that this might be an attempt to inject some new energy and get some new readers?
It very well might be, you know, an attempt to inject a bit more energy into the publication after last year its circulation dipped for the first time in more than a decade. Clearly, they need to do something to perk things up. They have tried a few digital initiatives, such as launching The Economist Espresso, their new kind of daily shot of news.
It's great.
It is. It's very good, and it's quite refreshing in their approach, which is all about this kind of very brief, just what you need, get clued up approach, which is great. So they've got that going. They've got their various audio podcasts and a sort of fairly pared back site with just a few blogs and their usual weekly content. So there's quite a lot of scope for doing something new. They've talked about bringing in foreign language versions of The Economist. And I know that emerging markets, particularly India and China, are areas of focus. But all that is, quite a few plates to spin, and all the while retaining what is the core of their proposition, which is this fantastic kind of cohesive economist worldview and very deeply reported news and analysis.
Christine, in terms of the mechanism of getting more women into the top editorial jobs, how should it be done? I mean, should we start to dip our toe in the water in the kind of lands of positive discrimination, like the Labour Party do, for example, with all women shortlists when it comes to parliamentary selection? Or do you think this is something? I mean, she clearly got it on merit. Some might say that some women ought to have got the senior jobs in other periodicals but didn't because they're women. How can we get around that?
I'm not a fan of targets or numbers or positive discrimination at all. I think that backfires and I don't think we need it. I think we've come on a long way since then. At the end of the day, I believe that people should get jobs because they're good at them, irrespective of whether they're a woman or a man. I think as bosses, we tend to have different ways of doing things. I personally think some women can be a bit more collegiate than men, but then that's kind of an old way of looking at things. I think the way that bosses work has really changed in the last sort of 10, 20 years, maybe due to the influence of women, I don't really know. But I don't think that targets are a good idea. I think that any employer wants to recruit somebody who's going to do a really good job. They also want a workforce that reflects their audience or their readership. And so it's not much point appointing somebody who's completely out of tune with your audience or your readers. So whether it happens to be a man or a woman depends obviously on your publication. Maybe there are lots and lots of women who want to edit a fly fishing magazine. Mm. And there's no reason why they shouldn't. But I think all jobs have to be given on the basis of meritocracy.
Some feminists would say that there's an institutionalised bias that like hires like. If you're white, male and middle class, when it comes to hiring, your subconscious preferences come to light and you're eventually going to hire someone who looks like you.
Well, a classic example of this in The Economist is the fact that both of Zani's predecessors as editor went to not only the same university, Oxford, but also the same college in Oxford, Magdalen. And there's clearly, you know, for good and for ill, a small amount of diversity within the workforce there in terms of the educational background that they had and, you know, all sorts of attributes other than gender.
Exactly. I mean, she came from exactly the same background as they did and she got the job anyway. Maybe we should be looking much more about... So I actually think what we should be looking at as an industry is a bit more social mobility. I think the gender division is something that has been really bad in the past, is improving. And as I said, I think it's up to women to sort of punch their way through. Glass ceilings are in their minds, not actually in real existence. I think social mobility is much more important. I don't know if you saw over the weekend, the Debrett's 500 influential people. Mm. You know, a lot of them are from private education backgrounds. At ITN, we've just started something, in fact, it started today, conveniently. Our first apprentices have started, and we specifically went out to try and find kids who haven't got the money or the social background to go and do a master's at City University. We're getting people who are 18 years old who haven't necessarily had the same advantages in life. And the idea is to try and get these kids and give them the tools to be able to compete against the kids who come out of university with masters in journalism.
It's also operating to what the spirit of apprenticeship should be about.
Exactly. And as I said, I think social mobility is the story going forward in terms of diversity. We're not there 100% with racial diversity or ethnic diversity. Well, I think we're getting there in terms of gender diversity, but I think social mobility is something that we can all do. And I also think that when you are at the top of an organisation or the middle or any time you're in a position where you are hiring, you have to ask those questions to yourself. Am I giving the job to somebody because they're the best at it, or am I giving them a job because they remind me of me? And I think breaking that is really, really important, whether you're a man or a woman.
So next up, Netflix has announced plans to reach 200 countries by 2016 and will raise at least $1 billion to finance the expansion. The company suffered a litany of bad news at the end of last year, slowing US growth, spiralling costs and losses internationally. Cinema and even traditional TV stubbornly refuses to die, and online viewing figures still aren't making a dent just yet. Robert, do you think Netflix is being too ambitious?
No, I think they're in this fantastic position where they are, you know, by far and away the leader in online video subscriptions. They've had a huge success of things in the countries they're in now. In the US, they've been doing fantastically for a while. Internationally, they're still making a loss. But in the first countries they moved into internationally, including the UK,
they're doing well.
They're now profitable. So I think it makes a huge amount of sense to move from 50 to 200. It's obviously going to be extremely complicated doing that. Each local country needs a certain amount of local content, a particular marketing approach. There's technical issues about broadband regulations, speeds and so on in each country. So logistically, it's a big undertaking.
It's a nightmare.
Exactly. But, you know, if you can raise $1 billion in debt and, you know, you're
you've
a listed
got the money
company.
To sort it.
Absolutely. What, you know, why not? They've clearly got a very, very strong recipe. You know, they're doing a lot of global content licensing deals. If you're getting that content, you know, on a global basis, then you might as well go into as many countries as you can and try and make money out of it. So I think they're pursuing absolutely the right strategy. Of course, the devil will be in the detail of the execution, but it's the right thing to do.
And what do you think the motivation behind it is? Is that they're not wanting their competitors to steal a march on them? Or do you think it's just plain old simple corporate expansionist ambition?
A bit of both, but if we've learned anything from all these other big internet companies like Facebook and Google, it's that the biggest one wins, and they're all absolutely obsessed with just cornering the market, getting as many users as possible. And with the Netflix model, you can see how that model makes sense, because the bigger they are, the more subscribers they get, the more money they come into the door, the more they can afford to splash out on these original productions of their own, like they've done with House of Cards and
Orange is the New Black.
Exactly,
and so on.
Which have both been fantastically successful. Clearly, it's a fantastic thing for consumers that there's a new player who's willing to spend serious amounts of money on high quality content.
Mm. Christina, what do you think? Do you subscribe to Netflix? Are you a watcher of it?
I've got a Netflix subscription, but I haven't actually watched anything on it because I managed the other day to actually get my telly to be able to take internet downloads, but I haven't actually got that further. So perhaps I'm a bit of a Luddite in that respect.
Perhaps you're their ideal customer, then, aren't you? Probably, paying them and never using it.
Probably. I think, but you know, interestingly, the thing about the successful brands that have been out there in terms of the digital startups, and you know more about this than I do, but they are massive, aren't they? We haven't got little regional Facebooks all over the place. We've got one big Facebook. We haven't got kind of, you know, a Google version, a version of Google that only operates in West Africa. We've got Google, which is global. Mm. And I think they have to be ambitious. And it'll be very interesting. I was doing a bit of research and I saw that there's a streaming service called Stan, which is launching in Australia ahead of Netflix launching in Australia later in March, I think. And I bet we'll see a situation in about 6 months to a year's time where Netflix is buying those local services and taking them over. Because it seems to me that these big internet companies, they need almost, the whole point of them is that you can watch them anywhere and they mean the same thing to you anywhere in the world. So I think actually being hugely ambitious is an important part of their business model.
Robert, do you think it might be, the analogy slightly breaks down because there are lots of different competing VOD services that have different libraries and different arrangements with studios and so on. So, for example, me, I subscribe to Netflix, but I also have Now TV, Blinkbox and so on. Perhaps it might be that Netflix is just one player of many.
Absolutely. I mean, I think people are increasingly going to be subscribing to a whole bunch of different propositions and they might drop one for a bit, pick another up and you know, go on in that vein. But Netflix clearly has a growing amount of competition, not just from these smaller niche providers, but also from Amazon, which you know, hit the news recently by hiring or commissioning Woody Allen to produce a TV series for them. Increasingly, these big technology players are willing to pour large amounts of money into content as a way of locking consumers into their sort of systems. In Amazon's case, it's, you know, it's sort of online retailing. In Apple's case, it's they're, you know, selling their phones and iPads. So I think you're going to see more and more money kind of pouring into producing this sort of high quality TV and film content, which will increase competition on Netflix. So now is the time for them to be really bulking up.
I think that I was just going to add, I think that anything that means that more content is being commissioned, I think is fabulous. Mm. You know, it means that there are more high quality dramas out there. There is more to choose from. And for those of us working in the industry, it's fabulous. You know, actors and actresses and lighting guys and electrician guys and cameramen and all that kind of thing. It creates business for them. So the more players in the market commissioning more drama, more comedy, rather than just recycling the same old, you know, Only Fools and Horses or whatever. Not that I don't like Only Fools and Horses, but the more content being created, I think, is brilliant for business and particularly for British business, which also does very well out of all this.
But Christine, in terms of your viewing habits, you've mentioned that you've subscribed to Netflix, but you've not watched it. Although that you could be a really good customer for Netflix, you might also be a nightmare because you might cancel the subscription. If I might ask, why have you not watched anything so far? Because quite a few people are talking about difficulties in terms of broadband speed, access, availability, and indeed the library. You know, Netflix has quite an odd library. It has, as Robert said, some specially made shows, but then it has like all of the old BBC shows that very, very few people watch. Why have you not watched Netflix yourself?
Well, the backstory to why I'm subscribed is my 12-year-old daughter nagged me to get a subscription when she got a laptop for Christmas. So she's been watching loads of stuff on Netflix. Well, for me, because the library stuff, the stuff that's on library, I can kind of, I've got another media supply at home and I can watch it on that.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, there's only so much time in one's working day. And, you know, there's any sort of, I probably only watch an hour of telly a day that isn't to do with news. So I'm kind of already served by on-demand services elsewhere.
Mm.
I would imagine I would keep up my subscription if I didn't have my daughter nagging me. I would keep up my subscription to watch things like House of Cards and Orange is the Only Black, unique content that I could only see on that platform. So I think the more of that they make, the better. But in terms of reruns of old series, I can watch that on Virgin Media. I can watch that on Blinkbox. I can watch it in all sorts of places. So I would need to have them keep creating new content for me to watch.
I mean, Robert, do you think that Netflix might move into some kind of offline viewing model? For example, you know, all the albums that I have on Spotify, I have available offline, so even if my internet connection isn't that strong, I can still listen to them. You can do that on iPlayer now. I'll often set iPlayer to download the thing I want to watch that evening so that if it just happens to be a high-traffic evening on in my broadband, it doesn't matter, I've already got it loaded. Do you think that's something that they might consider?
Possibly. I don't know exactly how complicated it would be in the kind of licensing negotiations to get those particular rights. I know with Amazon's film package as part of its Prime bundle, you can download to own things. I don't know actually if that physically means you don't have to be, you don't have to have an internet connection to watch it once you've downloaded it. But there's a, you know, clearly different models in the market, so I don't see any reason why not. On this point of Netflix having a rather bad library of stuff, I often find that, you know, I'll be flicking through Netflix trying to find something to watch and failing, and I'll go out of the app just, you know, feeling pretty frustrated and resolve, right, I'm gonna stop my subscription. But then it's just low enough priced, you know, $5.99, that, you know, it's like the gym membership, you just keep hanging it in there, and then, you know, you hear about some good show that they've got on there, you watch it, and then it keeps you going. So I suspect that they've actually got a huge number of subscribers who are just hanging in there, who probably don't use it necessarily that much, which could be a problem for them once more kind of compelling rival propositions come onto the market.
Do you think, Christine, a final question on this, do you think it's changing the nature of how we view ownership, though? Because in the old days, you would buy an LP or a tape or a DVD, whereas now, whether it be music streaming on Spotify or you know, Orange is the New Black, Sons of Anarchy, Breaking Bad, in the old days, I would have bought that box set, whereas it said, now I've actually watched it online. I don't care about not owning it. Is that an issue for you too?
I don't think so. I think people own something in their minds rather than physically now. So, you know, if you're into Breaking Bad, you're into Breaking Bad. Whether you've watched it on a box set or whether you've downloaded it, it's your program. You talk about it, you know, you chat about it to your mates at work or whatever. So I think the kind of ownership, if you like, I don't think anyone ever kind of looked at the box set proudly and thought, oh, I own that. Mm-hmm. I think our participation in programs is much more sort of emotional than on that level. So I don't think the fact that we don't actually physically own it makes much difference. Not from my point of view.
But Robert, if you give someone a box set of a TV show, at least it's something you can wrap, whereas if it's a credit card voucher that says this is good for six seasons of Breaking Bad, it's a less impactful gift, isn't it?
I agree, but if someone gave me a DVD, I'd thank them nicely, but I'd be pretty frustrated because I don't have anything to play it on.
I don't have a DVD player anymore either.
So, I mean, I think for something like music with, you know, CDs or, you know, vinyl, where you are going to put it back on a whole bunch of times, you know, repeat listening. You're not really going to do the same with a video or a TV show. At least, you know, I won't, you know, watch something more than once in a blue moon. So I just think, you know, in film and TV content, you know, streaming is absolutely the way forward.
And finally, The Times recently reported that The Sun had scrapped Page 3 after the story female breasts failed to appear in the paper for 2 days straight. And so despite a lack of confirmation, or indeed mischievously any comment from the paper at all, the media and Twitter felt they had all they needed and promptly went into meltdown. But topless models soon returned under a pretend clarification column which read, "We would like to apologise on behalf of the print and broadcast journalists who have spent the last 2 days talking and writing about us." Christina, was this a very clever or very stupid PR trick, or was it a battle behind the scenes? And do you think it's time for Page 3 to go once and for all anyway?
I think there's no such thing as bad publicity. It's an old phrase and it's still a good one. This was a very clever bit of cheeky marketing, which you would kind of expect from The Sun. As a journalist who was interested in reporting on the story, I was a bit frustrated that they wouldn't comment on it. I have to say I fell for the put the story in the Times because I assumed that was
sanctioned. It was putting it in the Times that was the genius stroke.
It was really, really clever. I don't think the way they handled it afterwards was terribly clever. You know, the head of PR sort of tweeting pictures to MPs and politicians and female journalists.
For that.
I know he has.
I know Dylan.
He
overreached himself.
Yeah, he did overreach himself, and it was a shame really because it marred what I thought was actually quite a clever bit of PR. As I said, cheeky and what you'd expect. It upset a lot of people. It put the discussion about Page 3 firmly back in the limelight, which
well, that's why it might be a stupid PR trick, because there was a lot of people saying and agreeing that it was just a relic of decades gone by and we shouldn't be having this in a modern paper.
I mean, personally, I think it's an anachronism. I think it's a bit of a sad sort of. It's like your sad old uncle at a party, you know, who's had a few too much to drink and probably needs to go home. And that's my view on page three, really. I'm not, you know, particularly personally offended, but I just think the idea that you open a newspaper and there's a pair of women's breasts staring out at you, I just think when people fail to find that offensive or shocking, then it means that they become desensitised, if you like. And we all know there's much, much worse things out there you can get very easily on your iPhone, but at least on your iPhone you're doing that. So personally, I think it's an anachronism. Interestingly, they've been sort of playing with things over the last few days. So I don't know if you saw today's a rather strange display of a lady with a pair of melons, real melons.
Actual melons. As in the botanical fruit.
That's exactly. Yeah. I couldn't tell what variety, by the way. But I don't know what their long-term game is on this, whether it was an organised campaign or whether it was... I can imagine that somebody sat around going, gosh, you know, circulation's not great at the moment. Let's cause a bit of a storm. I know what. Let's take on the liberal media and let's play the game with them about page three. And I suspect that's where it may have come from. What it does in the long term, I don't really know. I mean, I think it, as I said, it reignited the discussion, probably made more people sort of make statements like myself. I've never been asked for my views on page three before, and now I am. So what it does in the long term, I don't know, but it was just a bit of clever, cheeky, sudden PR.
But you wouldn't stitch up the newsroom of Channel 4 News, for example. They might be on a different floor, but they're still colleagues in the same building. Do you think it was fair of the Sun if they did stitch up Alex Spence at the Times, who wrote the story? He can't be feeling pleased with himself because it's his reputation and that of the Times. They printed a story as fact, and it's clearly not.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know the inside story. Were the Times aware that they were being taken for a ride? Were they part of the, was it a company-wide tactic, and maybe they were brought in as part of it? I would imagine if they had been left on the outside, they might be smarting a little bit, but that's the kind of rough and tumble of the newspaper world, whether you're in the same building or not.
Robert, boobs.
I think the Times supporters must be fuming. I think they've definitely sort of had one pulled over them.
Been stitched up.
Yeah, but that said, who knows, and I wouldn't want to guess what happens over the next few days, but my feeling is that they have made a decision to, over a certain period, phase out the boobs on page three.
You think they were testing the water, dipping their toe in the water with a withdrawal, see how it might play?
Yeah, I think they were having a bit of fun. Maybe there's a testing element. I think they, you know, the last thing that these guys at the Sun want is to have people think that they've been forced into anything by, you know, the No More Page Three campaign and you know, all these feminists who've been sort of, you know, campaigning that way. So this is a way for them to feel like they have a bit of a laugh. You know, they're doing it on their own terms. So, I mean, since the kind of cheeky wink, topless shot on Lost Thursday, I think it was, you know, we haven't had any boobs. No doubt they will reappear at some point, but I think it's generally going to be on the way out.
Maybe as a marketing ploy, maybe you don't know whether there's going to be boobs, so you need to buy the paper to find out.
Well, in fact, I mean, the potentially serious marketing ploy is that they do have them online. Now,
at page3.com. In fact, that's classic PR because I didn't know that website existed until this furore.
Neither did I. And I mean, if you're the Sun with a pretty low online subscription audience, you know,
behind a paywall,
exactly. You know, a tiny fraction of their daily print circulation. What better way to try and eke a few more people over onto your digital side than to try and tempt them with boobs?
It's a bit anodyne, though, isn't it? I mean, because without paying any money, you can see, if that's your desire, you can see an awful lot more online. So I'm not really sure whether people would want to pay for that necessarily.
I agree. I don't think it would necessarily work, but I think
that was the shock desperate about page three, actually, .com, when I realised it existed, is who would go to it, given, you know, what I've read allegedly is a
people.
Very large amount of porn on the internet. He said carefully.
There was an interesting piece that the BBC arts correspondent
Will Gompertz, I saw that piece. He was really good,
and he made the point that one of the reasons that page three has lost its impact commercially is that, you know, people nowadays are obsessed with celebrity and having some unknown
model
exactly.
Yeah.
It you know isn't really that compelling. So celebrity has killed page three, if you know, nothing else.
But Christine, asking you a question as a journalist, as it were, clearly the Times had run this story. It was the Times, their sister paper, so there's some merit in it. You open up the Sun on page three and there's not a bare-chested lady. You can understand why the media reacted, even though they might have overreacted. Did you find it quite frustrating that they refused to cooperate with you at that point? Because you wanted to run a story on it on Channel 5 News, but you would have wanted the confirmation.
Yes. I mean, we got rounded in the end. We talked, you know, we basically said, you know, is it the end of page three? Ran through the sort of for and against arguments and sort of capped it with, you know, Sun wouldn't comment and we'll have to see what happens. So we kind of treated it with the scepticism that it kind of needed at the time.
So you didn't do the full Harriet Harman and do a big thing saying we've killed page three?
No, because personally I haven't killed page three and Channel 5 News hasn't killed page three. So we sort of did it as is it the end of?
But they stated with certain, my point was they stated with certainty that it had gone, when in fact no one actually quite knew that, did they?
No, and that's why we didn't make that, we didn't say it had gone because we couldn't actually tell.
But you must have badgered the Sun behind the scenes to have given
Oh yeah. And I, as I said, I personally haven't got great personal contacts with the Sun, but I was a bit sort of miffed that, you know, they, as soon as they were refusing to confirm or deny, it's always, it rang a few alarm bells in my head, to put it that way. So it was a bit frustrating, and I have to say, if they were one of my contacts and he hadn't sort of come clean with me, I would have been a bit personally annoyed. But I did regard it as a typical sort of cheeky Sun ploy, if you like.
Robert, what would you have done? I mean, I don't know what the FT's equivalent of page three is. Maybe it's the Lex column, which we all love. But you know, if you guys were thinking of getting rid of that, how would you play it internally?
Well, I don't think there'd be any scope for the kind of tomfoolery that the Sun's engaged in. Well, I don't know about internally, but externally, I think it's kind of dangerous. If you're in the business of news and in the business of trying to report stories, you know, that are factually correct, playing these kind of shenanigans in which you're, you know, saying one thing's off record and then, you know, other things on. I mean, it doesn't look good. And it's after everything that The Sun and the various Murdoch papers have been through, you do question whether it was quite the right way to play things.
They would argue, look, they didn't lie. They didn't not tell the truth. They just, you know, kept their cards close to their chest, if you excuse the pun. And so they've got no real problem in terms of how they handled it, they would say. It just raises a little kind of question mark in your mind about, is everything always as it seems, if you've been led down a path before? As I said, if they were sat in this room, they'd go, well, hang on a minute, we didn't tell you that we had banned it. But it does raise a little sort of question mark, I think, in my mind about is everything always as it seems?
I mean, for the Times to have reported it in the way that, with the certainty that they did, they must have been given some information by someone within the Sun that that it was.
And
it
they
was
might
gone.
Not unreasonably feel misled, perhaps.
Yeah. I mean, you do wonder how this was all played, because for something of this importance that Rupert Murdoch's traditionally been interested in, you know, tweeting out about page three from time to time, he must have had some inkling of what was going on as well. He must have been consulted on a decision to phase it out or not. I suspect that's what happened. He was consulted, they took a decision, we will. And then there was a little bit of shenanigans.
Let's
about
have a play
the
with
exact
it. Let's have a game.
I mean, Robert, clearly there's been some tomfoolery, shenanigans on the part of the Sun here, but do you think that it might have backfired against them, given that it, once again, page three is in the spotlight and many people are criticising it rightly? I mean, Christina, you mentioned it as a kind of drunken uncle, but it is slightly lecherous. It is sexualising, you know, young female bodies, and it's not hardcore porn on the internet. This is on page three of a very, very well-read and very well-subscribed to national newspaper. Is that an appropriate place to be sexualising young women's bodies?
I mean, this is the big question that's dogged it for decades, but I think it's just become increasingly irrelevant. I think that's the problem. You know, if someone wants to look at topless women, there are plenty of places they can find them that's not in the pages of the Sun. And so what is the real benefit of having them in the Sun? You're instantly alienating a large potential audience who aren't going to want to necessarily have that paper on their family table, you know, because of the message it might send to their children. So it seems increasingly irrelevant. And when you look at what's happened to the lads mags in the UK...
They've covered up, haven't they, basically?
Well, they've been forced to cover up, and also, you know, Nuts went, you know, folded last year. Zoos sort of, you know, dwindled to, you know, circulation in, you know, almost nothing. They're all, the demand for them has just evaporated. So you just begs the question, well, what is the point of page three?
Well, I think we've grown up a bit as a society. I mean, you know, look at those, the sort of the 80s Ladette culture of boozing and drinking. And if you look, you know, recent surveys have shown that the youth of today is an awful lot more conservative than they used to be before. They drink less, they take fewer drugs, they stay out later, they work harder. Presumably, they look at pictures of naked women less, certainly in newspapers. And I think you're right. It just feels a bit of an old-fashioned anachronism. Mm. In the era of post-Savile, when behaviour in the 1970s and 80s, where people groped you or made inappropriate comments, was kind of brushed away, we're not like that anymore. We've become a lot less tolerant to sort of bad behaviour or the margins of bad behaviour.
And rightly so, of course.
And rightly so. And so I think, as I said, I think we've grown up a bit as a society, and sort of staring at someone's naked breasts over your cornflakes in the morning or your bacon butty just feels a bit, as I said, old-fashioned.
What interests me as well is, you made a comment, Robert, about people not even looking at this as if it's like a newspaper advert where you just kind of turn the page. But I when I come on the train into London in the morning, I read the morning newspapers on my iPad, and I have the Sun's app. And automatically, when I go to page three, I always put my hand over the iPad without even thinking, not just so that I can't see it, but I don't want to offend my passengers on the train. And then I just scroll to the next page. So it's actually worse. It's just a knee-jerk censorship. And I wonder how many other readers they're alienating in that way. But, I mean, who wants page three? Christina, when you were on running these stories, did you do any vox pops with people out in the street that said, oh, I love page three, etc.?
Well, there were a couple. You know, it was the, I'll be stereotypical, but it was the kind of white van man and the guys in cafes who said it was all innocuous.
The kind of people beloved by Emily Thornberry,
MP. Well, possibly. But I think, you know, as I said, the women don't, you know, most women don't particularly feel great about wanting to see it. It's interesting about the online behaviour. I was chatting to the guy who runs the digital media side at Northern and Shell, because we're in their building. And he was telling us that the social profile of the Daily Star online is ABC One males, because they could never be seen reading it on the tube with the paper, but they can read it on their phones and their iPads because nobody can see. And I think maybe that's what the page3.com thing tries to tap into. People who might be too embarrassed to be seen to do that. So it's very nice you putting your hand over it, but maybe other people are holding their iPads and their phones a bit closer because they don't want to be seen to be looking at page three.
Yeah, but you've seen those things on the internet, those memes where people are on trains and you can read their screen from the reflection in the train window or in their own glasses or something like this. I think if you're going to be looking at things like that, it shouldn't be on public transport anyway. Christina, how do people follow you on Twitter and how do people interact with you online? Do you have a blog? How do people stalk you?
They don't. I've had a few stalkers, actually. I've had a few Twitter trolls in my time, which comes with the territory, doesn't it?
It does, unfortunately.
I'm not probably as good as I should be at promoting myself.
Because you're putting the programme together.
So I'm sort of promoting the programme rather than myself. So I don't write a blog.
How do we watch Channel 5 News then?
On the telly at the moment. You have to watch it on the telly, the old-fashioned way. And you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at @newsgirlc5news.
Robert, how do people follow you on Twitter? Do you have a blog? How do people stalk you?
On Twitter, it's @Robert_Cookson. And the FT's just added some functionality to our website whereby you can follow individual authors. I think you just click on their byline and it'll give you an option. So that's another option.
Well, I might even subscribe to follow you.
And I might do that as well. And you can follow me on Twitter if you're so minded, @PaulWRBlanchard. And don't forget, you can go to mediafocus.org.uk, where you can leave your email address and receive an update once a fortnight when the new podcast is out. But that's it for this one. Thank you ever so much for listening. The associate producer was Jordan Greenaway. I'm Paul Blanchard. Catch you next time.
A Big Things Media production.